Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hello and welcome to Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast. This time, we're looking back into our archive to November 2018 and our Composer Focus series as Edward Seckerson and countertenor Yestin Davis delve into the life and music of composer George Frederick Handel.
Hello and welcome. I'm Edward Seckerson and with me today is countertenor Yestin Davis. Our subject, George Frederick Handel. Yes, and it could have been considered bad timing to be born in the same year as J.S. Bach, if you're a composer. But Handel more than held his own in that era. I mean, you're biased, obviously, because you're a singer, but where do you put him in the pantheon of Baroque greats?
I think certainly at the top, alongside Bach, anybody who doesn't know of Bach or Handel probably does without realising they've heard their music at some point, whether it be on television or in a film or just on the radio. But I would say they both achieved that sort of top ranking in Baroque music in similar but also very different ways. Handel spent most of his time working in the theatre and working in the sort of secular world, and Bach worked in the sacred world most of the time. We don't believe that they ever met. They were close to meeting. And I think just the nature of their jobs and where that took them on their journey, and in Handel's case it's sort of via Italy and then eventually to England, but through the theatre world and through patrons who paid him to write music for their sort of courts, I suppose, and in England in particular for the court and for the what we'd call the West End now.
Yeah, we tend to forget how practical.
Yeah,
these composers were of that era, and they saw where the demand was, and they went for it. And Handel, I mean, created what, three opera companies in London to provide for the rich and the elite and the opera loving upper classes.
And I think it's important to remember that what we consider as a composer these days, or as a musician in general, is very different to what was happening in the 18th century. You know, musicians weren't necessarily just given one job title. So today you might say I'm a violinist in the London Symphony Orchestra, but a violinist back then might have also been a composer, might have also been a dancer. And so Handel was playing to his strengths, writing for the theatre, but so was Bach, writing for the church. And I think if they'd been alive today, they would have been the Thomas Adders, the George Benjamins of their day. The music would have been as I suppose, as inventive, as different, but would have sounded much more like music we're used to hearing today. If you go back and listen to music not by Bach and not by Handel, by some of the minor composers of the Baroque period, it sort of sounds like pastiche of Handel, but not as good.
Yeah.
So I think in a way, whilst they're writing at the time in a style that we associated with the 18th century, they are still, had you gone back then, they are the revolutionary composers who really made their business successful. But at the same time, it really comes from a true place. Bach and Handel came from a special place, whether it be in their soul or wherever, they had a gift. Statistics are staggering. I mean, 42 operas, 29 oratorios, 120 cantatas. I mean, those are probably rough figures. There were the Concerti Grossi, organ concertos, and the two greatest hits, the water music and the fireworks music, the music for the Royal Fireworks, which is especially sensational, I think, in its supersized wind version. Mm. But most importantly, it was about the voice, really. And so, as a composer for the voice, what sets him apart from a singer's point of view?
I think Handel had, without it sounding glib, he had a gift for a tune. Now, that's quite a difficult thing, as any successful pop musician will tell you, to come up with a good tune. Essentially, pop music runs off tunes. Without a tune, there's nothing. And there's lots of Baroque music that's very beautiful but doesn't necessarily have a tune to remember by. And as a singer, when you're given a tune, it just lifts everything off the page straight away. And what was great for me about coming to singing and learning how to sing through Baroque music, through Handel, was the way in which he connects with you through the tune, and through that tune's connection to the harmony underneath. So he's able to move you in a very suspicious way. You can't quite work it out, but it sort of takes it beyond any other composer of the time. He sets words well in terms of he understands how the voice works. So in some of the fast arias you get to sing, you have these runs, which are called coloratura runs, and he understands that certain vowels work better for a singer on these fast runs. And you find that out when you translate them into English, for example, at English National Opera, where they do everything in English, and you have to find the right words to fit the difficult technical demands. Mm-hmm. And you start to realise how Handel completely understood this. He also worked so closely with the singers in his companies, in his opera companies, that he was able to tailor make each aria for specific singers. So you have a broad repertoire of music written for a specific singer. Mm-hmm. And I know, for example, that if I sing an aria that's written for the castrato Senesino, it'll fit my voice. I don't need to actually check up on it before. I know that I open this opera, there'll be a load of arias I can sing. And likewise, there are some castrati he wrote for who were higher in their voice than Senesino. And so for me, that's not necessarily something I'd sing.
Yeah, and subsequently, the public got to know these singers. They were the pop stars of their day, weren't they? I mean, they were hugely important and influential. That's changed a bit, although there are still the operatic superstars, but they were phenomenally famous.
Yes, I think they were, I suppose you could say pop stars, but I more like film stars, I think, because not everybody was able to go and see them. In the flesh, because not everybody went to the opera, but they sort of held that place that I suppose the celebrity gossip magazines would hold today of a celebrity, just because of the tales of their enormous fees or their sort of diva tantrums, or in some cases just leaving the country altogether to go and do. Farinelli famously left the London opera scene after only two seasons to go and sing for the King of Spain, where he stayed for 20 years. So if you imagine that today, it's like a footballer turning up to Manchester United having paid 70 million or something, and the next season just disappearing and saying, actually, I've had enough, don't like Mourinho, I'm going. The difficulty for Handel, of course, was to hold on to these singers and to find replacements when they left. And again, that's all to do with the business acumen. So there was rival opera companies, and bums on seats really ruled the day. And when that didn't happen, opera seasons were ruined and careers were ruined, and Handel lost money and theatres closed, and he had to change tactic, which he did. Lush,
for the benefit of those who still find the business of voice types in Baroque opera confusing, including us probably, the countertenor has assumed roles normally written for the female alto or the male castrato.
Yeah.
Is that a fair summation?
It's a fair summation. In a nutshell, countertenors sing in their falsetto range. We know them really from cathedral and chapel choirs of this country in the choral scene, and since the 1950s they've been much more prevalent on the operatic and the concert stage because of the interest in music from the 18th to 17th century, and composers such as Benjamin Britten and Michael Tippett bringing back the interest in this music and saying, well, what kind of voice did we hear then? Well, we certainly had a man standing on stage, so we want to see a man and we want to hear a man, but we don't have castrato anymore, so we'll use the falsetto voice. Now, that's led to people assuming that countertenors are the automatic choice for these roles, but they're not, because, as you said, they were written for men who were castrated or women playing trouser roles. However, that leads me to add that Handel did work with countertenors, and in quite a few dramatic, as in operatic sort of situations, in the later oratorios, he wrote specifically for a countertenor. So Handel's Jephtha, some of the Messiah arias he's performed with countertenors. There's a number of oratorios in which Semele, which a countertenor would have featured as a soloist. So it's not completely inconceivable that had the castrati not been around, there might have been a sort of equivalent in the countertenor range.
Mm. This distinction between opera and oratorio has become less pronounced in the modern age because we have a whole range of creative directors, for better or worse, whose imaginations can run riot on a piece that was normally performed in concert. Is that a good thing?
I think anything's a good thing where it brings more light to a piece. In the case of the Handel oratorios, actually I find them more dramatic than the operas. The operas, to me, feel very stop-start and very static in places. The arias themselves are wonderful and very moving, but as a whole sort of thoroughly composed evening, I find them less convincing. Often they deal with slightly unbelievable subjects, and the drama towards the end has to sort of hurry up to find a moral or to get everyone wedded off or to bring back the dead people so they can sing in the chorus. Whereas the oratorios generally are based on biblical stories, which are in themselves, you know, stories of thousands of years of history, of storytelling. And Handel deals with them in a very different way. And perhaps that says something about his own religious convictions, I don't know. But I find that for a modern director to get their hands on the oratorios gives them, in a way, more license to bring theatrical and directing styles to them than you can do with the operas. I think they lend some more interesting interpretations.
Yes. I mean, you mentioned how ludicrous the plots can be, but always the emotions are very real, and that's why they work so well still.
And I think we put on a, you know, that's me putting on a demand on opera based on a 21st century point of view, which is that I don't think in Handel's time they wouldn't have cared so much about the whole arc of the evening as we do when we look at a piece of theatre nowadays. We want to sort of believe that these characters are actually there. And I think sometimes you can miss the point. With Handel, it was about saying, here's a character who in 4 minutes is going to express and investigate the emotion of grief or love or loss, but in a very sort of under the microscope way. And what happens with the oratorios is it's a bit more thoroughly composed, so that you might not get a style of aria called the da capo where you go back and sing the opening tune again, which in opera happens all the time.
Yeah.
Whereas in the oratorio, Handel started to move the drama on. Mm. There was a lot more choruses involved, and perhaps some of the arias were shorter, so that the emotion expressed is much more about about getting the story on to the next, onto the next section. And going back to what we were saying about his working with singers and understanding the voice, he understood also that by doing this and moving the drama on, he stopped the singers from indulging.
Right.
Because the singers tended to indulge. They tended to ornament too much. They tended to request arias that weren't written for them, for the opera to be sung. And they'd come along and say, I'll only sing in this if you bring this aria in, because it's a successful one of mine. And I think this eventually got on Handel's wick. And he really turns the screw when it comes to oratorio. And he says, this is much more about the drama. It's something that later composers such as Gluck understood completely and changed the form of opera.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Can we conclude, Yasin, by just talking briefly about his most famous piece, which is The Messiah, which most singers of your ilk probably roll out a couple of times a year, or certainly at Christmas, or whenever. Do you do it often, and do you ever tire of it? Because what makes it so iconic?
Well, I do it often, but it's mostly in December. It is really a sort of Lent and Easter piece as such, but that's not the way it's done now. So traditionally, it's done at Christmas. It's the only piece that I perform where I write inside the score how many times or where I've done it and who with. I just decided to keep a record because I thought I'd be doing it quite a lot, and it's turned out that it is that I've done it probably about, I don't know, 100 times, something like that, since 2005. I don't tire because we don't do it between January and November, generally. If you do, maybe once in March or something. It's nice. It's sort of like seeing a best friend who you don't need to talk to every day, and then you turn up in December and you sit down and remember old stories from last December and you chat about that. It's very like that, and it sort of sits in the voice again without having to do too much work.
Is it familiarity with the piece that makes it so loved by the public, do you think?
A bit, but I think you can go to it maybe one or two times, maybe the second time you hear it, it's the genius of Handel in which he very subtly draws you into the whole drama of the piece. And I think it would be putting Handel down to say it's just familiarity, because I think that's true of all Handel, the familiarity with, especially with his operas, which are kind of long and not always full of great arias. Familiarity makes you think it's a better piece,
But, you know, for example, doing Handel's Saul at Glyndebourne, I love, that's my favourite of Handel's oratorios. I absolutely love it. But I can understand why somebody coming to hear it for the first time would say, OK, well, a few listens and I might get it, but there's only one really famous aria in it, O Lord, Whose Mercy is Numberless, which thankfully I get to sing. But for me, it's sort of the choruses that lift it. It's wonderful. And I think that's the same with Messiah. It's got, it's got that sort of rousing chorus element to it, which an audience feel like they are singing along, even though they're not, especially in the Hallelujah chorus, where I suspect most people are in their heads trying to sing along, and often audiences do try and sing along when they're not invited to, but that's actually wonderful, and nobody ever questions that, and it wouldn't... It'd be strange if people started doing that in, I don't know, Elijah or something. It just sort of happens in Messiah, and it's accepted. And we take it for granted, and we shouldn't, because it's something very special that Handel's done there to make everybody feel part of it without them having to take part. For me, is the it illustrates what Handel's very good at, which is the way he manages drama and tension and climax and release. And you'll find this in a lot of his pieces, but obviously in Messiah, which is more familiar, he builds the music and the drama to a point where you think it's the end, and then just as you're about to climax, he stops everything and puts in a beautiful aria such as I Know That My Redeemer Liveth, or If God Be For Us, just at these peaks, and creates what you think is a trough. You think, oh, time is stopping. But that's exactly what he wants you to think, because he wants you to stop. He's got you in the palm of his hand, and you listen to this most wonderful piece of text delivered to a most wonderful tune. And then he builds back into a big rousing chorus that's not your, I suppose, it's not necessarily fireworks and glitter, but a much more sincere piece of music which just sends you off on a huge high. And I think that always reminds me of how people describe a DJ who plays a crowd and is able to manage a number of records and mix them in such a way that he builds a whole evening, and he's playing it over, he or she is playing it over several hours in a club. And you hear people saying that, you know, they like a particular DJ because they understand the crowd in front of them, and yet they're not speaking to them, they can just see a swathe of people, and they will build an evening around some climactic point, and it might be 3 a.m, it might be 4 a.m, but they very carefully manage all the beats, the speed of the music, the keys in which they're playing things, and then they cleverly mix them in such a way that you have highs and lows and highs and lows, and then this very big high. And Handel, in a way, does exactly that. He manages all the expectations of the audience, and he manages to bring you in and let you down and bring you back up again. And Bach and him both have this fascinating way of doing that. And I feel that the chorus at the end of the Messiah, the big Amen chorus, for me is on a parallel with the end of the Bach B minor Mass. And the two pieces climax in such a way that the B minor Mass has the beautiful Agnus Dei solo for the countertenor or the alto soloist, which in a way is that moment where the tension is just released and held, and you're left with this beautiful slow tune, and you just wanted the piece to finish, and then he gives you gold, and then there's this wonderful climactic sort of fugal chorus at the end. And the same thing happens with Messiah, and there's a wonderful bar right at the end where this pedal seventh happens, and it just, for me, that's rather cheesily where Christmas begins on the last page.
Thanks to Yestin Davis and Edward Seckerson. In the next episode of our Composer Focus series, baritone Roderick Williams joins us to talk about the one and only Benjamin Britten.
The first thing is that I come to him with my composer's hat on rather than a singer's hat on. I think he was the composer who first woke me up to classical music in a way.
Until then, thanks for listening to this archive edition of Nothing Concrete from the Barbican. You can subscribe on Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if possible, leave us a review to help us inspire more people to discover and love the arts.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.